Welcome to a new episode of Clot Conversations from Thrombosis Canada. I'm David Airdrie, Executive Director, and I welcome our co-host, Dr. Maha Othman from Queen's University in Kingston, and Dr. Jamil Abdurrahman from Toronto General Hospital as co-hosts. It's great to be back. We're here to provide you with updates on diagnosis and management of thrombosis, featuring interviews with authors of recent research publications and highlights of education programs from Thrombosis Canada. Thank you for joining us for this episode.
In this episode, we'll be discussing a paper from Thrombosis Research entitled Pharmacokinetics of Directoral Anticoagulants After Bariatric Surgery, a Retrospective Cohort Study.
And we're very pleased to have two of the co-authors with us today, Dr. Barbara Gunka from Hamilton and Dr. Siraj Mithwani from Burlington. Dr. Gunka is a fourth-year resident in hematology at McMaster University, where she also completed her internal medicine residency. She's the current chief resident and has interest in community hematology. And Dr. Siraj Mithwani is an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine, McMaster University, and works as a clinical hematologist in St. Joseph's Healthcare in Hamilton, where his practice is focused on non-malignant and thrombotic disorders. He completed his medical degree, residency, and fellowship at McMaster University and graduated with a master's degree in health professions education from Maastricht University in the Netherlands. His research interests are in knowledge translation, laboratory monitoring of anticoagulants, and postgraduate medical education. Thank you both for participating in our podcast today. So to begin with, I think it would be useful if you could kindly explain to us the VTE risk in relation to bariatric surgery. What do we know about the prevalence of VTE in association with this type of surgery, either in Canada in general or from that registry, and maybe also the thrombosis sites that are commonly seen?
Thanks, Maha. So I can't comment on the Ontario Bariatric Network Registry data in particular, because we didn't collect this data as part of this study. But I can speak to the risk of VTE more generally after bariatric surgery. So as you might imagine, severe obesity with its associated comorbidities, undergoing major surgery under a general anesthetic, and having perioperative immobility all confer a higher risk of perioperative VTE. We know that DVT and PE are the most common sites for thromboembolism after bariatric surgery, but occasionally we do see portal vein thromboses occurring as an early post-surgical complication because of the intra-abdominal inflammation. The incidence of DVT and PE in these patients varies, of course, by center and between studies, but it's in the range of 1% to 3%. And most events occur after hospital discharge within the first 30 days postoperatively. Unfortunately, there are no well-validated risk assessment models, to my knowledge, specifically evaluating the risk of VTE after bariatric surgery. And so the duration of postoperative VTE prophylaxis varies across centers, usually in the range of 7 days to 4 weeks. But more importantly, actually, many patients, as you know, who are undergoing bariatric surgery already have atrial fibrillation or a history of VTE, and they may already be treated with a directoral anticoagulant preoperatively. And most of these patients place a high value on remaining on a DOAC postoperatively, if at all possible.
Right. So you mentioned that a lot of these patients are already on DOACs. So what's the concern for the DOAC use post-bariatric surgery?
Yeah, so the concerns with DOAC use post-bariatric surgery is that the current procedural approaches to kind of get the weight loss that patients are hoping to achieve occurs through restricting gastric volume, limiting digestive capacity, and or causing malabsorption. All of these mechanisms have the potential to result in anatomic and physiologic changes that can alter oral drug pharmacology. It is known that the absorption of direct oral anticoagulants primarily occurs in the upper GI tract, where postoperative changes in GI motility and or luminal surfaces can lead to decreased absorption and resultant bioavailability of these drugs. The other concern with DOAC use is that in this patient population, they've only been included in small numbers in the existing data, and there's not much around safety and efficacy in this specific subgroup.
Thank you for this. So wondering, what are the current guidelines suggest for DOAC use in the setting of bariatric surgery?
I think the main guideline that the listeners of this podcast will be familiar with are from the International Society on Thrombosis and Hemostasis, or the ISTH. And there was guidance published in 2021 by Dr. Martin and colleagues that addressed the use of DOACs for prevention and treatment of VTE among obese patients. They also commented on the appropriate use of DOACs after bariatric surgery. Now, those guidelines suggested not using a DOAC for the treatment or prevention of VTE in the acute setting, meaning immediately after bariatric surgery, because of concerns about the decreased absorption post-op. And instead, in the acute setting, they suggested initiating these patients on parenteral anticoagulation, for example, with low molecular weight heparin in the early post-surgical phase. They suggest that after 4 weeks of treatment, one might consider switching the patient to a vitamin K antagonist or a direct oral anticoagulant. But if a direct oral anticoagulant is chosen, they suggest obtaining a trough DOAC drug level to check for drug absorption and bioavailability.
Okay, great. So you guys conducted a retrospective cohort study looking at DOAC use post-bariatric surgery. Who did you include in this study and what were the outcomes you were looking at?
So we included all DOAC-treated patients who underwent bariatric surgery at St. Joseph's Healthcare Hamilton, which is our regional bariatric center. And that was from December 2015 to March of 2021. And those people were primarily followed by our thrombosis consultative service. We also used the Ontario Bariatric Network to see if there was any other patients that could be included within our cohort as well. The primary outcomes were the mean peak DOAC drug level and the proportion of peak drug levels within the conventionally accepted on-therapy range seen in phase 2 and 3 clinical trials. And practically speaking, what that meant is that all the patients that were seen by the thrombosis service were instructed on exactly how many doses to take and how to time drug administration and phlebotomy to represent a peak level. That exact time was then communicated back to our thrombosis service and was recorded, and we were able to identify the exact time of drug level from our EMR system, and that helped us identify that it was truly representative of a peak level. And furthermore, the team sort of asked the patients whether it was administered properly, whether that was to be with food, and that kind of also helped us decide if those levels were done appropriately. The secondary outcomes were 30-day incidence of arterial or venous thromboembolism, major bleeding as defined by ISTH, and mortality.
Sorry, just to confirm, so going back to the DOAC levels, you mentioned you look at the DOAC levels from pharmacokinetic studies. So these are not validated therapeutic ranges, but these are something else. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I don't know if Dr. Mithiwani wants to add to that.
Yeah, I think you got it, Jamil, that these are basically the ranges that were seen in those studies. But just for the benefit of the listeners as well, there really is no established therapeutic range for DOAC drug levels, like there is for the INR and warfarin, or the APTT or anti-10A level and the heparins.
Thank you.
Right. So I guess, what did you find regarding the DOAC levels?
So we had about 56 patients that were included in the study, and we looked at their first DOAC drug level done after bariatric surgery and found that 21% had a drug level that was below that expected on therapy range that was seen in phase 2-3 trials. We then went on to look further at different DOAC types, and starting with rivaroxaban, which contained the most patients, we had 29, of which 7 had a peak drug level that was below the expected range. 6 of those patients were on the 20 milligram daily, and 1 patient was taking a 10 milligram daily rivaroxaban for thromboprophylaxis. What we were able to identify is that no patients were switched to a vitamin K antagonist. However, 3 were switched to apixaban and later had a level that was subsequently in the expected range. And 1 patient had a dose increase from 10 milligrams to 15 milligrams. However, there was no level available to see whether they were then in what would be the expected range for that dose. And the other two patients had levels that were only marginally outside of what would be expected, and they were continued on treatment at the discretion of their thrombosis provider. apixaban had the next highest amount of patients in that group with 21, and only one patient had a level that was outside of expected range. That was simply repeated and happened to be in range, and there was no changes made to treatment for that patient. In the edoxaban group, we only had three patients, but every single one of those had a level that was within expected range. And lastly, in the dabigatran group, all peak levels were below the lower limit of detection for our assay, and all patients were switched to alternate DOACs, one to rivaroxaban and three to apixaban, and all subsequent levels were in the expected range and they were continued on that treatment. And as per our local practice, which I think will be touched on, we did have data for 15 patients who had drug levels that were repeated at a median of 6.5 months postoperatively, and all peak levels done were within the expected range, similarly to their initial level. And we wanted to see at that point what was the weight loss post-bariatric surgery, and that was about mean loss of about 27 kilograms compared to their preoperative weight. However, BMI was still considered to be morbidly obese, even with that weight loss.
Well, thanks for that. I'm wondering if you have seen variation between individuals' levels post-surgery, and if there's any intra-individual variation as well.
So as you might expect, Maha, DOAC drug levels vary quite a lot between individuals and also within individuals if you remeasure DOAC drug levels serially. So the sample size here is pretty small, so we can't draw definitive conclusions about the variability in this population. But I'll tell you what we found. Between individuals, basically, there was considerable variation in the peak drug level. And just to give you an example, the mean peak apixaban drug level for patients undergoing a laparoscopic sleeve gastrectomy was 171 nanograms per mil, but this had a sizable standard deviation of 66 nanograms per mil. So you can imagine that the distribution is quite wide. We didn't see any obvious trends with respect to how the variability compared between different surgeries, but again, the sample size was small, and we lacked sufficient power to conduct a statistical analysis in that regard. As Barb was discussed earlier, though, we were less concerned about the specific drug levels that were achieved by the patients, and we were more interested in the proportion of drug levels that were actually below the expected range seen in phase two, phase three clinical trials, because the ones that were below that interval, that suggests that those patients had malabsorption of the drug. And then finally, in terms of intra-individual variation, there were relatively few patients in our study that had multiple drug levels drawn during the time period. But the coefficients of variation for apixaban, rivaroxaban, and edoxaban ranged from 21 to 26%, which is consistent with what has been seen in other DOAC-treated patients, for example, who are treated for atrial fibrillation.
Right.
And the study looked at clinical outcomes as well. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we looked at the 30-day outcomes and specifically wanted to know about arterial venous thromboembolism, major bleeding, and mortality. When we looked through that, we had two patients that had events. So first patient was someone that was taking rivaroxaban 20 milligrams daily preoperatively, and they had a pulmonary embolism that was diagnosed on postoperative day two after a sleeve gastrectomy. They had received only one dose of weight-adjusted low molecular weight heparin for VTE prophylaxis on postoperative day one, which would have been standard at our center. And in kind of looking through the consult note, it sounds as though prior to surgery, they were not taking the rivaroxaban with food, and it's unclear if that played a role at all. And the other patient was someone taking rivaroxaban 20 milligrams daily for atrial fibrillation, who was readmitted to hospital on postoperative day 19 with sepsis and was diagnosed with an incidental splenic infarct of unknown chronicity seen on CT scan. Both patients were treated with low molecular weight heparin while in hospital and eventually resumed rivaroxaban. There were no major bleeding events as defined by ISTH criteria and no deaths. One limitation is the possibility that patients undergoing surgery at our regional center may have sought care at different healthcare facilities for postoperative complications, which we would not have necessarily captured as part of our data collection. And furthermore, the study, as mentioned, was underpowered to make any definitive conclusions about clinical outcomes.
Great. Okay, so you mentioned the limitations of events occurring outside of your center and of limited sample size. Are there any other limitations we need to keep in mind when interpreting the study?
Yes, there are, Jamil. So one important thing to note is that this was a retrospective study, of course. And really, we were evaluating the outcomes of our routine clinical practice at St. Joseph's Healthcare in Hamilton. So we aim to measure drug levels in all patients systematically who are on a DOAC post-bariatric surgery, but there remains the potential for selection bias, and we may not have captured some individuals who are at high risk of DOAC malabsorption and maybe at the discretion of the treating clinician were initiated, say, on warfarin postoperatively rather than a DOAC. Another key aspect in terms of interpreting the findings is that we only included patients who underwent bariatric surgery essentially for weight loss. So we did not include patients who had GI surgeries for other reasons, for example, cancer surgeries. We also had a short follow-up period for the clinical outcomes in addition to our relatively small sample size. And we have to also acknowledge that there is no established therapeutic range, as you mentioned earlier, Jamil, for DOAC drug levels. And so this is really a surrogate outcome. The correlation between peak drug levels and clinical outcomes is still uncertain. And there is also some uncertainty about when to measure the drug levels. I'd mentioned that the ISTH guidance suggests measuring a trough drug level. But if you look at the literature in this area, most studies, including ours, are measuring a peak drug level with the rationale that we're trying to find out whether the patient is having an issue with absorption rather than with bioaccumulation of the drug. So there is, you know, still some ongoing debate and variation practice on when the drug level should be checked.
That's fair. So if we put together the guidelines that are known right now and the findings from your study, what do you think we should be, how should we manage DOAC use in patient post-bariatric surgery?
So put to the center stage, the key finding is that in our study, we showed that around 20% of patients who had undergone bariatric surgery are at risk of DOAC malabsorption. And the individuals who seem to be at highest risk are the ones who had undergone a highly malabsorptive surgery, like Roux-en-Y gastric bypass or biliopancreatic diversion with duodenal switch. And also patients taking dabigatran appear to be at high risk. We can't make confident recommendations about the optimal DOAC after bariatric surgery, but in our small cohort, apixaban appeared to perform the most favorably, with only one of the 21 drug levels below the expected on-therapy range. I'd say that overall, our findings support ISTH guidance that parenteral anticoagulation is likely preferred in the immediate postoperative setting because of the risk of DOAC malabsorption, especially for patients who are at high thromboembolic risk or who are being treated for acute VTE. Now, if a DOAC is selected afterwards, I think that this should be done in a model of shared decision-making with the patient. And if the local resources are available, we would agree with the ISTH guidance that checking a drug level is reasonable. Now, whether that's a peak or a trough drug level is under some debate. The ISTH suggests a trough drug level. And if the drug level is below the expected range, one might consider switching the DOAC and trying again and making sure that the drug level that was drawn actually represented a peak or a trough to assist in its interpretation. In our cohort, we actually didn't need to switch any patients to warfarin, meaning that we were able to identify a DOAC that was absorbed adequately for every patient. But if there's uncertainty or in patients who are at high thromboembolic risk or who are not accepting of the risk of malabsorption, then of course warfarin would be an appropriate long-term choice.
Right.
Perfect. Thank you. And is there anything that we haven't discussed today that you'd like to bring up?
I don't think so, Jamil. Barb, anything?
I think the only thing I was going to say is that there's, I think, quite a bit of difficulty in having these levels done and having them done appropriately, which I think you sort of mentioned with the sort of prior question. So that was the only thing I was going to add.
Thank you all for joining us today. Really appreciate the great conversation. And I want to thank the audience for listening to Clot Conversations from Thrombosis Canada. We welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions on the podcast. And if you have any recommendations for future podcasts, please send them to us at info@thrombosiscanada.ca. And please subscribe to this podcast so that you are notified about the release of new episodes. And don't forget to check out our website for education programs, clinical tools, and guides. Also, please consider donating to Thrombosis Canada to support our ongoing efforts to reduce morbidity and mortality due to thrombosis.